when I got kicked out of Classe Préparatoire, back then I definitely felt it like a failure. Like, I wasn't proud of it. And in hindsight, I genuinely think that it's the best thing that came out of it for me, because I was able to spend much more time in the startup ecosystem, meet this passionate crowd that I get to work with day to day. Don't bother about the studies in the sense that you currently bother about it. And most importantly, and that's something that I actually tell, especially French people where the education system is quite rigid, is like, any day of the week, I'd rather hire someone who's got a bachelor's degree and work experience rather than someone who's got a master's degree, no work experience, and maybe some misplaced expectation that through a form of salary of work, they should get something in return because they've spent 5 years of studying. So biggest piece is, don't worry too much about this. Just focus on meeting the right people and being in business with them.
Hey guys, I'm here with Antoine Moirud, partner at Lightspeed. Lightspeed is a venture capital firm focusing on multi-stage investments in the enterprise, consumer, and health sectors. Lightspeed invests in seed, early, and growth stage companies. For over 20 years, Lightspeed has been the first investor and an early backer of some of the most innovative companies in the world, like Snapchat, Carta, and BetterUp, among many, many others. During this episode, we discuss about Antoine's journey from failing Classe Préparatoire to becoming a partner at Lightspeed at 28 years old. We discuss the firm's commitment to Europe and a 105 million euro seed investment into the talented team of Mistral AI.
A startup named Mistral AI has raised a 105 million seed round, they're calling it. Should be at about a 240 million valuation, according to reports. One of the co-founders is a DeepMind researcher.
Why these rounds are so big is, I guess, that you have to buy all these H100s and they're expensive and these rigs are very expensive. I mean, you guys saw this, that Nat Friedman basically published that he spent $75 million on a bunch of hardware, and if you were one of his portfolio companies, you could use it.
This episode is brought to you by Zoom One, designed for however and wherever your team gets work done. Whether you need some focus time or want to collaborate with your hybrid team, Zoom One is the all-in-one platform designed to power your workday. Collaborate with your team and clients across phone, video, messaging, whiteboards, and even connect your favorite work apps so you can focus on getting things done. Simplifying your workday and keeping your global team connected, one platform to connect, Zoom One.
I think we met a couple of years ago at an event in Stockholm. I think like we were playing Kill, Fuck, Marry.
I remember it was in Stockholm. Like I think we'd attended an event and then we went on to have a drink with a few folks. That was a while back, but it was fun. So good memories.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I remember you were like with EQT back then. You had some changes in your career. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about, you know, your role at EQT. And then I know that you've joined Lightspeed, and maybe what motivated you to join Lightspeed.
Yeah, for sure. If you want, I can roll it back to just one step before into like how I landed at EQT. My first jobs were in startups. So I started working at Flixbus in Germany in data science. At the time, the reason for which I came into startups was a bit random. It just so happened that I'd studied statistics in German. I'd spent time at my local incubator and I was like, might as well try to figure something out that uses both German and statistics. And I stumbled across Flixbus that was hiring at the time. So that was my first step into the world of startups. Then went on to work at Dataiku, which is a French data science company. And after 2 years there, I went on to pursue a master's in data science. And as I was going to go back into that world of data science, wasn't really expecting anything else. I came across a Typeform, so just like on a random newsletter from EQT Ventures that I'd been following. Instead of announcing different venture fundraisers from their portfolio, they were looking for someone. And they were looking for someone who had experience in data science, who had an interest in startups, who was keen on going to the UK and then coming back to France. So it's a lot of things that, you know, on paper ticked my interest, and just had a chat with the team. And that's how I landed in that world and stayed with the team until I think March of last year, and officially joined the Lightspeed team in September. So it's almost, yeah, I mean, it's going fast. It's close to a year.
Great journey. And what did you know about venture capital before you joined EQT?
I didn't know much, to be honest. I think it's one of those things that, you know, once you're into venture, and you probably have this yourself, you sometimes have junior people who ask you about how you can break into venture and such. I think I'm one of those who really just randomly stumbled into it. The background story for me of venture is really through the lens of startups, because I guess the origin story is that when I came out of my studies, when I was 18, in France, when you have relatively good grades in high school, what teachers tell you to do is to go into this course that's called Classe Préparatoire, which is a 2-year intensive course to prepare you for the competitive entrance in business school or engineering school, whichever you prepare for. And I did that for a year. I wasn't good enough in maths. So they told me, thank you, but no thank you. And so I went to public university after this. And in public university, you move from an environment in which, in classe préparatoire, it's a very sheltered environment. You've got a lot of people aligned with the same goal. They know what they're doing for the 2 years. It's constant work. To public university, where a lot of people don't necessarily know what they want to do in life, and you have no structure that's really supporting you to know what to do. So I had all of a sudden a lot of free time. And because I had free time, I started hanging around with a few people at the local incubator. And the reason for which I stumbled there was that I just liked the fact that people were passionate about doing things. The thing that struck me when I went to public university was just, yeah, a lot of people didn't know what to do, and I don't blame them. But I preferred being around people who were like, you know, they weren't doing anything that was venture scale at all. It was like, I'm going to create some handbag brand. I'm going to create some Afro products for, you know, just for hair. And it's through that lens that I got into that world. And then the venture piece was an add-on to it where, oh, when you're part of a startup, sometimes they raise capital. And through my lens back in the days, it was very much, oh, we've raised money. I guess we're going to celebrate together onto the like next milestone type of thing. But that's pretty much all I knew from venture at the time. So not much.
And what are, let's say, the most important 2-3 things that you've learned about venture capital and about the industry while at EQT?
I guess when I went into the world of venture, one thing that I witnessed very quickly, and it was interesting because in the context of EQT at the time, and it still is one of the core pitches of EQT, a lot of the team are former founders or operators. And so what was interesting there was that there wasn't really anyone with a venture track record of having, you know, been a board member for the past 15, 20 years in the world of venture. And so what was interesting was that we were kind of all learning that craft together. And one of the things that in my first year I learned was that when you're a former operator, irrespective of the sector you're in, I guess, sometimes you have the bias of having ran into walls yourself as a founder or an operator, and you want to make sure that the founders themselves that you're supporting don't repeat those mistakes. I think one of the humbling realizations I had was that when you're in venture, you're not the captain of the ship anymore. So you're just supporting founders. And the best you can do is share your lived experiences, but it doesn't mean that necessarily they'll make the same mistakes, or the mistakes that happened with you back in the days are still applicable today. And so one of the big learnings for me was definitely the humbleness and understanding that, you know, you're there to support, but you're not there to drive as much as the founders are. So that was my big learning. If I was to attach it to a second one, I guess, I mean, you'll probably sense it through the conversation, but one of the big themes that I think is important in venture is just being constantly curious about things, whether you're in a verticalized fund, a generalist fund. I think just chasing curiosity is something that's really important. And while you may not reap the rewards in the first months or even years, I think that curiosity compounds and you just meet great people, you learn new things. And that's something that I think is super powerful.
Absolutely agree. You do have to be constantly curious to learn about new industries and see how new industries get disrupted. But also you have to be humble because maybe what worked before will not work now. So you always have to be testing. And so I think there are like all the biggest and best VCs that do have an anti-portfolio, right? And that's the reason that's very, very, very humbling. And tell us the story when you left EQT and you joined Lightspeed. How did that happen?
Well, so I think I was at the time reaching on almost 4 years at EQT. I really loved my time there, and I've only got good things to say about the team. I think it was just at a personal point in time, you know, in my life where I was trying to think about the next thing. And I, at that point in time, I was actually considering starting a startup in the risk and compliance space. So back in 2019, I'd spent a lot of time from the venture side looking at all the possible KYC players that were around there. So, you know, the Onfidos of the world, the Verifs, and a bunch of others. And my conclusion back then was that making an investment in that space was maybe not what we would want to do. But as I was studying the space, I discovered the whole mess that is KYB, so know your business, and the validation of identities of startups and businesses. And there it's quite fragmented. It's still very pen and paper type stuff. So I spent a bit of time there with some people from Passbase and trying to think a bit about what we could turn that into. And that it didn't end up going anywhere because, you know, for X or Y reason, I think we didn't really match in terms of the energy that we wanted to put into the business. And coincidentally, at that point in time, roughly around that period, I was also having some early conversations with Lightspeed, but which were very much through the lens of like, let's just chat, not through the lens of a hiring interview. And then, as you know, things progressed that we realized we weren't going to start the startup. I started speaking a bit more with the Lightspeed team. And yeah, I mean, it took quite a while. I spoke, I think, with 9 to 10 people on the team, but it never felt like an interview process. It was very much a conversation and, you know, trying, and we'll touch on this together today, I think, but getting the potential to just really understand what do they have in mind for Europe, how do we think about supporting founders, the multi-stage approach, a lot of the questions that you'd have, you know, when you think about making a move that will last for quite a while. Because here, you know, the Lightspeed presence, we're putting together that office in Europe and planting that flag more than Lightspeed has ever done it before. So that's quite a commitment that goes with it, I think.
Hey there, this is Paul. When we first started talking to Antoine, I think what really sort of struck us was that he was actually quite technical and he seemed to almost love getting deep into themes and topics that other people weren't spending too much time on because he was intrigued by the technology. And I think we had at this point met at least a couple dozen candidates. And so we were really looking for people that were, I think, had substance, that were more than just sort of apprentices in the venture industry or in finance, but actually had some kind of unique experience or deep-rooted conviction in new technology areas. And so Antoine just sort of ticked a bunch of those boxes. And then we just spent more and more time together and just really kind of enjoyed hanging out. And then that was validated when we asked people in the market, founders and other investors, what they thought of him.
You just started with Lightspeed quite recently. What is like the biggest difference between EQT as a fund and Lightspeed?
I think the biggest difference between the two, I'd say, is EQT is a super successful platform financially across a variety of business lines. So I think EQT is really a textbook example of growing AUM along different strategies. So private equity, real estate, infrastructure, venture. And even within venture, there's a subset with the venture fund, but also the venture growth team. And there, I think it's a super example of how you're able to scale different teams. When you look at Lightspeed, Lightspeed only has one strategy in that it's venture and growth. So there's no side asset lines if you see it from a very financial standpoint. And the other difference that comes with this in some sense is that Lightspeed has been in the business of venture for, you know, since the late 90s, early 2000s. So there's a lot of learned experiences there, whether it's, you know, companies that go on to IPO or the scale of the companies that we've been able to back because some of them have had insane outcomes. And so it's both a balance between seeing the venture world through the lens of a venture-only fund, but also the scale of the experiences and that the fund also allows for. Because when we invest as Lightspeed as a platform, we're able to invest, you know, checks at the earlier stages up to the very pre-IPO stages. And being able to cover that whole financial muscle is something that's quite interesting to also witness across different geographies.
Also, what's very interesting is that it's a global platform, but it almost seems like a one team. In yep. the sense that you would look for category leaders across the globe. So you do have this knowledge yep. sharing across what works across different industries and where do you guys think that the next category leader might rise?
Big time. So it's one of the things that I'd say that to a certain extent I came to find within Lightspeed is that, you know, I sit on the enterprise team, which is everything that covers, you know, B2B SaaS, developer tools, infrastructure plays. And that's where I spent most of my time. And the knowledge sharing that we have there across India, Israel, Europe, US is something that's been super useful. And, you know, the latest deal that we did in Europe with Mistral is really an example of this. We met with a bunch of teams across different geographies. And then collectively, we were able to say, look, there's a great opportunity ahead of us. How do we think about this? And I think that had we not seen this international set of entrepreneurs that were trying to tackle a similar problem, we probably wouldn't have had the confidence to make a move on the Mistral team and offer to work with them, because we wouldn't have had the confidence in and the understanding that they were some of the most competent folks with a good understanding of what it takes to build beyond a large language model. So that's one example. But, you know, beyond an actual deal, I think there's a lot of conversation that we have around the back to your, you know, one team thing. We internally we sometimes talk about one Lightspeed, because the idea is to have no ego relative to what makes the best company. And for instance, on the fintech side, we spend quite a bit of time thinking about account to account as an emerging theme. And one of the big discussions we were having is where do we think most of the value will be created globally? And it was super useful to have an understanding from the Indian ecosystem about how their, you know, account to account has grown, having an understanding of how the Australian market has grown, LATAM. And that's things that, you know, unless you're spending time with people who spend time in those ecosystems, it's very hard to get a good understanding of those different industries.
I love actually to go into a little bit more detail on the Mistral example, but maybe before we go there, we can talk a little bit about Lightspeed's commitment on Europe. I know that Lightspeed announced its EU office in September 2022. Also, I think then it was like when I talked with your colleague, Paul. How do you guys see Europe now, and what is the firm's commitment to the region?
That was maybe the most important part for me in evaluating whether I should join Lightspeed and the partnership and the team there. I think that, you know, founders, operators, funds have all witnessed how some EU funds, you know, built their presence locally, but also how some US funds went into the ecosystem in Europe and perhaps, you know, not quoting anyone, but have had more maybe of a satellite office approach or a tourist approach and went back to their core geographies when the market got a bit more tough. The dedication that, you know, and the commitment that Lightspeed has to Europe is complete in the sense that A, we've got an independent team that's able to move ahead quickly on deals. And so we've got the mandate to lead deals directly from Europe without having to have this sort of subsector of a whole platform. So that's something that gives us a lot of opportunity and confidence in the European ecosystem. And then the second piece is that Lightspeed as a platform, which to me, funnily enough, went international by going into India and China before going into Europe. And I think that just culturally, having an understanding of the challenges that Lightspeed went through as a platform to scale on those different time zones with the different cultural nuances, seeing that Lightspeed managed to establish a successful franchise in India was something that was very comforting to me individually when thinking about joining the team and assessing the cultural fit and the cultural plasticity or elasticity towards having a European office. And we speak a lot with the Israeli team as well because they've gone through those growth motions of building a global platform. And it's been really interesting to see how that applies in the European context. I think for us, when it comes to investing in the space in Europe, we've invested now, I think, in more than, I'd say, like 32 or 33 portfolio companies across Europe. So we haven't been out of that ecosystem. It's just that now we've got the conviction that by having a local presence in Berlin, in London, in Paris, we're able to see more of the market and support the founders better on the ground.
You also mentioned that once you have the agreement that this is the best team for this industry. So I would assume that you have the mandate for Europe and India has the mandate for India and then the US for the US. How do you take then these decisions where you want to invest and it affects the industries across geographies?
That's something that we spend quite a lot of time thinking about. And in terms of structuring the ICs and, you know, just the decision structure of the team as we've grown is something that we've kind of been iterating on and revamping. Now, I think that, and you know, oftentimes people, especially in the French ecosystem, ask me, oh, so you're covering France on behalf of Lightspeed. And what I try to remind them is, look, we're a team of four partners across Europe. Our goal is to back the best entrepreneurs across Europe. There's not necessarily this geographical focus because I'm based in France that I'll only be doing French deals. Mm-hmm. And that scales internationally as well. And so what this means is that, say, for instance, we see some exciting opportunity. Let's take the example of large language models. We see some exciting opportunity in a competitor to some bets we've made in the past. If we feel that there's something that warrants a second look, so if we feel, for example, there's something that's very, very exciting that's coming out of India, what we'll do is that we'll bring in the enterprise team to support as well in evaluating this with the global lens. So what that means is that if we see that there's some exciting opportunities in, say, vector databases, if we think about vector databases and there's exciting approaches coming out of a certain geography, our work is to make sure that relative to all the existing teams that are working on this problem, we think we're in business with one of the most exciting ones. And so sometimes it happens to be India, sometimes it happens to be Europe, sometimes it happens to be US. Yeah, I mean, I think our goal is really to have this low ego thing of, even if you think yourself, you know, individually, you have an exciting business, perhaps relative to the other ones out there, it's maybe not the most exciting one. And so we try to have this collective understanding of, look, we just want to be in business with the best founders. And sometimes they happen to not be in the geography that you're actually based in. So that happens. And the good thing I'd say on the European side is that there's more and more of those examples coming out of Europe. So
super happy for that. I remember actually I took a course in data science when seeing that it's just so important. I think I did an artificial neural network and I just needed some data science courses. And I remember the instructor was French. And I looked at some statistics and apparently France has a lot of very, very, very good data science teams. And I was just so frustrated because we have so much research, but I didn't see a lot of very interesting investments in the space, like really knowledgeable and with capital investors to come and back really, really good talented teams. So I want to say that when I saw the investment in Mistral, I was very, very happy. So maybe we can touch a little bit upon the investment in Mistral. Do you remember like the first time that you met the team? I'm just curious about the story behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'll just bounce back on your piece around research before going into it. I think that Europe has a lot to learn from the US in terms of building dense networks between research academic environments and more startup environments. I think that, you know, it's much easier for people in those environments to quickly spin something up and raise funding on the back of some innovation that has come from a research lab. what we also need to do more work collectively on, I think, in the European level, is infusing that founder DNA within the academic environment, because I think that there's some very, very talented, as you rightfully said, scientists, research engineers, whoever they are working in the research field. And perhaps, you know, their collective brain power would benefit a lot in the context of company building, but they're just not necessarily considering it because they haven't had the exposure to what this can yield. But when it comes to Mistral, makes for a good segue, because my first encounter with one of the founders from Mistral was actually at a quite technical conference where there were a lot of research engineers. I think it was back in September last year. So just when I, on the back of me joining, I attended a conference on the implications of AI in formal maths. So it's on the topic of how do you use AI to prove equations in the world of mathematical research. And yeah, so just attended the conference there. And when there was a breakout session, you know, people would just go out and network a bit. And I landed in a group who was having a conversation on recognizing very obscure languages. And Guillaume, who happens to be the chief science officer at Mistral, was in the mix and was actually quite excited and involved in the conversation. And that was my first encounter with one of the founders on the team. And then fast forward to this year, we were having conversations with Stan and Gabriel, who are the founders of Dust, which is also a French AI company. Stan reintroduced us, saying that, you know, Arthur, who's the CEO, had been putting something together along with Guillaume and Timothée. And so that reignited the conversation on the back of that first introduction. So random occurrence of meeting at a conference and then the introductions that moved the needle at that point in time.
What was the pitch, as much as you can tell?
No, well, look, I think a lot of the pitch is very similar to what we've shared publicly. So there's not too much that I think is hidden. I think that what I can share is that they came to us with a vision of the world that matched a lot of the conclusions that we'd taken. And so I think one piece was that in order to build a global challenger in the LLM space, we had a very strong conviction that you needed to have top-tier engineering talent, which I think isn't reinventing the wheel. And in terms of looking at the track record of the three and how they complemented one another in the context of research, it was clear that it made sense for the three to get together. They had a great track record in research, but also in building large language models at scale. And that's something that I tend to emphasize quite a bit. When you look at the cohort of people who have exposure to, who have had, you know, over the past like 2, 3 years, 5 years, exposure to training large language models, many of them haven't necessarily had this experience at scale. And the largest clusters in the world to train models on were most of the time closest to the largest tech giants. And so that was something that was important for us. And then most importantly, you know, we had a lot of people come to us, raise money, very talented technical folks come to us asking for, you know, 15, 20, 50 million to train large language models. And the reality is that a lot of them hadn't necessarily thought through the next steps of what does it take after training a large language model? You know, what for? What are the business applications that you have in mind? How do you think about the way you're going to be selling those? How do you think about the political and strategic topics around it? And this is where the founders, when they came to us, they recognized that they didn't necessarily have that experience in the past, but the value that was in having those technical conversations and adding on top of it the layer around political, you know, sovereignty, we can dig further into this, but also business, was something that they knew from day one. So they surrounded themselves with relevant people at inception. So, you know, Cedric O, who's the former French Secretary of State for Digital Affairs, the founders of Allen, who have built a quite successful business in France on the insurtech side. And I think that showed that mentally they were ready to have something which was much bigger coming out of the research environment. Because I think that, back to what I was alluding to just before, a lot of those very technical founders don't necessarily have the strongest founder DNA and the urgency to push something through beyond the appetite to build and continue building in a research environment. And that's something that we felt was totally different to Guillaume, Timothée and Arthur. So I think that's already what was the first piece of the equation. So very strong technical background, an understanding of the implications of building beyond just a large language model. And then there was a layer around building an open source strategy and having a European anchoring. And I think the open source piece, both Mosaic and Meta released some open source models. Mm. The intuition was that in order to capture a lot of the appetite around building large language models, building open source was something that we felt was obvious in that direction in terms of building the community, getting feedback from the community. So that was a big piece of the pie. And then the second one, which I think has been most important in a European context, so not necessarily in a global context, but in a world where essentially China and the US as world powers are emerging as AI leaders and where Europe is trying to find its footing, I think that there's a case to be made that today, more than ever, we're having this flywheel of talent in Europe. We're having this flywheel of capital that's much stronger than it's ever been. And that whilst we may have missed the boat in terms of, you know, building data centers, in terms of building competitive search engines. There's a case to be made that today, because of the political implications of AI and the maturity of the ecosystem that has grown over time, having a European player is something that would be quite differentiated.
$105 million, I don't know, dollars or euro is a big round for an early stage startup. I would assume that a substantial amount of the money will go for GPUs, or how is the capital allocated there?
The headline terms are fairly simple. It's that, you know, it's quite a capital intensive race, both in terms of the talent that we're trying to attract, but also the compute needs. Mm-hmm. So of course, you know, it wouldn't have made much sense for the team to raise such a significant amount if it weren't for those two conditions. Yep. And for us, what matters most at this stage is making sure that they've got the resources to deliver on their ambitious plans. You know, they plan on delivering some models by the early next year. And so to make that happen, they also need to have the comfort and confidence that they've got the capital to support those projects. So I think in the context of GPUs, it's definitely a topic. And one of the reasons for which we made sure that they had enough capital for this fundraise was to secure those GPUs and make sure that they weren't bottlenecked by that specific need.
And how do you feel like the battle for GPUs? I just heard that now to get your hands on some GPUs from NVIDIA, there's a very, very long waiting line. Also, do you as an investor try to already kind of buy some or have that available or be in line for the entrepreneurs that you serve? How do you see that problem?
Yeah, so bouncing back on your last point, I think you're alluding to what was done by a few folks in the US in terms of securing their own cluster of GPUs to offer to lease it out to some of their portfolio companies. I don't think we're exploring this on the Lightspeed side, but what I'll say is that in the context of Mistral, both the quality of the team and the capital have made it such that the bottleneck for compute was less of a big challenge for us. So, of course, it was a strategic focus to make sure that we were able to secure this, but a lot of people were lining up because of the interest generated in the project and the approach that the team had. So we're making sure that there, in terms of compute, they're not going to be limited going forward. But beyond that, we don't really have a strategy around GPU acquisition or whatever it may be. I think that what we're seeing emerge is there's a lot of alternative players to the largest players today that are emerging. The reason for which we haven't invested in that space directly, investing directly in GPU players, I assume, is because when we've seen some players, we had concerns about the second act of the journey beyond the current GPU-constrained environment. Mm. And in order to pay back those GPUs, when you're a provider of compute, you need to have very high utilization rates to be able to amortize the cost of those infrastructure buys. And it feels that today there's going to be a sustained interest in GPU compute. But in the meantime, there's also a lot of work that's being done in terms of small models being more efficient, running things on CPUs. And so I don't have a crystal ball. We'll see where it lands. But my hunch is in a certain amount of time, perhaps the GPU need will decrease, both in terms of the output that NVIDIA's, AMD's, Qualcomm's of the world will be able to put out. But most importantly, perhaps because we'll have found more energy efficient ways and, you know, parallelism and such to compute the needs for large language models.
Let's change gears a bit and let's get personal. How old are you, Anton?
28.
28. Beautiful, beautiful age. Yeah. And now, like, you're a partner at Lightspeed. How does it feel? Such a big brand, such an important brand. Do you think that's possible only in an American company? Like, in the sense to see young talent that is hungry and say, okay, here's a lot of responsibility that we want to give you.
Well, I think, I'm very thankful for the trust that Lightspeed has put into me. Obviously, I think that the ability to, you know, irrespective of the titles, the ability to be a check writer is something that you have to treat seriously. And in the context of Lightspeed, but also within EQT, I think that what matters the most is, irrespective of the title, knowing that you have the trust from the team to be able to push the things that you believe in. And with that, you know, back to being personal and vulnerable, I think that a lot of this also comes down to your ability to shoot down your own excitement sometimes, because you may hear about things, you may go into conversations with a lot of excitement, and then, you know, you've invested a lot of emotional capital into business, into founders, but sometimes you just have to recognize that after having done the actual work on the business, it's not one that you'd like to associate the fund with. And I think that building that trust is something that takes time. And so depending on the understanding that different partners have, the ability to grow into those roles is maybe going to take a bit more time. I don't think it's necessarily a question of US or EU. I think I'm quite thankful to Paul in that regard for, you know, giving me and the rest of the team the autonomy to continue to do that work. But if I look back on, you know, if I'm doing some low-level history of VC funds in Europe, I think it's also perhaps that historically, and it's changing, a lot of the European venture capital ecosystem came from a world of M&A banking, which has more traditional hurdles to jump in some sense and more time-bound expectations around what it takes to become a partner and what it takes to grow through the ranks. So I think that's how I think about it, really.
And what is the moment of pleasure for you as an investor? Is it when you do the work, let's say, and you come with a prepared mind and you talk with a lot of founders that are building into a space, and then you find that one that you're just so aligned with, that kind of gets you excited? Does it get you excited to work with them when you see them scale, when they exit?
One thing that I miss a bit in the venture environment compared to working in startups or specifically in data science is just the amount of dopamine hits that you get. And so what I mean by this is that when you're working in data science, you're working on a series of projects. And I think that there's a direct correlation between the pain you experience in solving that project and the fact that you're able to solve for it. And so when you have a lot of projects that you're working on in data science and you just manage to break through something that you've been banging your head on the table for a while, you get that dopamine release much more than you do in venture, because, you know, oftentimes we talk about how the venture timeframe is a long one. You don't necessarily know how strong of an investor you are until quite a bit of time. The way I view the venture work is a fairly simple one. It's, if you think about the spectrum, and investors are going to spend different amounts of time depending on the seniority and also their own interests, but it's essentially, you know, sourcing, analyzing, winning, supporting. And one thing that I really enjoy at Lightspeed, and it's something that some other funds over time delegate to others, is the ability to do everything end to end. And so that percentage of time you spend on sourcing, analyzing, winning, supporting is going to fluctuate, of course, depending on where you're at in discussions with founders, the cycle of the fund, whatever it may be. But that's something that, in terms of long-term happiness, I really enjoy the ability to continue working across those different stages. But if I had to go back to the one-liner around what gets me happy, it's a very simple one. It's that, and it sounds cliche, but I'm passionate about meeting passionate people. And so I've got this thing where, you know, every now and then you can ask Paul, Julie, Alex on the team in Europe, or you can ask my girlfriend. I just show up into the office, or I show up home, and I'm like, man, I just met this person. They're insane. Like, I'm just so excited. And it's, I just rant. I just go on for a while. And then they know that they just need to listen to me for a bit. And then I just calm my excitement down. But when I have those moments of excitement, it's just like, that's really what makes me happy. Because I'm really like, if I wasn't in venture, I think I'd either be an entrepreneur or in startups, because I feel it's the place where you have the highest density of people who are passionate. Mm. And I don't really care what they're passionate about. When I speak with sometimes some operators or some angel investors, and they're like, oh, like, how can I help you? Like, do you want me to introduce you to some folks? I'm like, look, I don't really care so much for startup profiles. Like, it's just, if you've got someone that you came across that you thought was very smart and that you had a great conversation with, I'm very happy to meet them. Because I think that sometimes, back to this topic I was discussing about academia and founder DNA, I think the founder DNA can be unlocked sometimes. And it's not because someone wasn't necessarily in that startup bucket at a point in time that they won't be in the future. So yeah, that's big time what gets me excited.
And how did you learn to tame your excitement? It's okay, I will let myself to get excited, but I have this checklist that I need to check. I don't want to get overboard with my excitement.
That's a really good question, because I think back when I got into venture, it was maybe the first feedback that I got, is that it's good to be excited, but you also need to have thresholds in excitement in a certain sense. It's that, back to what I was saying, is that when you're, you know, if you get excited about a company in the very beginning, but then you signal to the team, you signal to the founders that you're very excited, is going to send mixed messages. So that already externally, in terms of messaging, is something that you need to manage. And then there's the internal piece of just the, in French, I just call it the yo-yo, the constant up and down of excitement and disillusionment in a sense, you know. So the way I learned it, I think, was just, and people kindly putting in the time to tell me, hey, you know, this is the reason for which it's not necessarily as exciting as you think it is, or this is the reason for which we're missing this element that could lead us to being very excited. And then over time, I didn't believe in this thing of the investor eye, you know, like the people were talking about this when I started in venture. Mm. And I think over time, you get it. It's just a question of keeping that investor eye for a quick look at what could go right and what could go wrong, but still having that curiosity, back to what we were talking about, of making sure that you don't get stuck in your way of, oh, I've seen this model before, it's not going to work out because XYZ reason. Goes back to this data science thing of, you know, hey, I've tried this, it won't work. Well, sometimes it does, so you never know.
Exactly. And what does success mean to you?
That's deep. What does success mean to me? Well, I think if I tie it back to the things that I think success, I feel privileged enough to be in a job where I'm excited to get to work every day, and I don't necessarily need to count my hours at work. And so success to me is where I've managed to find the right balance between fulfillment in my day-to-day, like personal life and professional life. And so, you know, very, very personally, when I got into venture, one of the things I told my girlfriend was that venture is a very sinusoidal curve, is you're going to have moments of very high intensity and going to have moments where maybe a bit more of a lull where, you know, you go back into working on like more long-term projects. Mm. And for me, and I'm still working on it, so I definitely don't have the recipe for it, but one of the things that I'm trying to hit right is the balance between making sure that I'm doing the work that I need to put in to make the fund successful, to also support my founders that I'm supporting and the founders of the fund successful, but also make sure that I'm not, you know, dropping the personal life because of that. And sometimes when you get in those peaks of intensity, those moments where it's really busy, I know that in the past I've forgotten sometimes about this. And, you know, I remember back in March 2021 when it was peak VC euphoria, peak intensity, I was working on three deals simultaneously. Two were Series Bs and one was a Series A. And I was doing most of the DD on that work. And, you know, I remember back then I spoke to my colleague and partner, Rania, and I was like, look, I'm really all in here. But the reality is that I think I'm a bit too much all in. So I'm going to drop some holidays in 2 months' time. We'll see where it goes. And then irrespective of what happens there, then I'll still be taking that time because I think that if I continue at this pace, I'm just going to burn out. And it so happened that at the time, it ended up during the closing of another investment round. But luckily, we had people in the team to fill in, and they understood that it was important for me to take that time. And, it, you know, it's one of those things where you go on holiday and then, yes, you're going to take a few calls, but that's okay. And that was what was important for me at the time. I think success is managing that difference in intensity between personal life and work life.
If Antoine from 10 years ago would listen to this episode, what would you tell him?
I'd tell him to care much less and stop overthinking about diplomas and studies. I think that my parents taught me to be good at school and get good grades because it gives you opportunity. And I think I maybe understood it a bit too much as your worth is determined by the studies that you do. And, you know, when I got kicked out of Classe Préparatoire, back then I definitely felt it like a failure. Like I wasn't proud of it. And in hindsight, I genuinely think that it's the best thing that came out of it for me because I was able to spend much more time in the startup ecosystem, meet this passionate crowd that I get to work with day to day. Don't bother about the studies in the sense that you currently bother about it. And most importantly, and that's something that I actually tell, especially French people where the education system is quite rigid, is like any day of the week, I'd rather hire someone who's got a bachelor's degree and work experience rather than someone who's got a master's degree, no work experience, and maybe some misplaced expectation that through a form of salary of work, they should get something in return because they spent 5 years of studying. So biggest piece is don't worry too much about this. Just focus on meeting the right people and being in business with them.
I like that. Don't worry about diplomas and follow your curiosity, as you said in the beginning, and just go and build something. You know, it can be like a small business, a scalable business, but just go and do stuff.
No, definitely. And I think today, so it's also with the bias of in the startup ecosystem, there's a lot of giving back. There's a lot of this idea of, you know, being able to put something out to the world and just the sake of putting that effort out to the world is something that's much better than, you know, if no one does it, you'll never know. And that's something that I push a lot of my friends, founders, whoever I speak with who are sometimes a bit uncertain is, you know, if you don't ask, you'll never know. So the best thing to do is just go out there and do it. And I think, you know, just candidly reflecting on my own road up to where I am, it's a lot of things have gone right because I at times reached out to people and they were kind enough to give me some time and consideration. So
wonderful. Antoine, thank you so much for taking the time. You've been very generous with your time and with your experience and with your learnings. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the invitation. See you around, Callum.